The controversy over so-called top-ups to senior hospital staff shows no sign of dimming, with the latest revelations centering on the Central Remedial Clinic. It's now emerged that five senior staff at the clinic are still in receipt of salary top-ups from an associated charity, Friends and Supporters of the Central Remedial Clinic. It's also been reported that the charity gave the CRC an interest-free loan to help prop up its pension fund. There have been calls for a government inquiry into the affair, and we'll have more on that later on in the programme. First, though, let's talk to Lorraine Dempsey, who's chair of the Special Needs Parents Association, and many of the people they support use the CRC. Good morning, Lorraine.
Good morning, Rachel.
How have your members been reacting to the news of the past few days?
Fairly harshly, actually. I mean, the fact that the CRC, that these funds are used for to provide state-of-the-art facilities. One parent just said, they might be state-of-the-art facilities, but they have skeleton staff, and they're queuing for services. They're queuing for seating appointments for quite lengthy times. You know, this is what happens when we have a historical outsourcing of services by consecutive governments. And the true cost of delivering these services goes way beyond what the HSC budgets provide. So they do rely on fundraising to supplement that development. And, you know, the CRC's fundraising arm would say that they do have an annual shortfall. It has to be made up through voluntary donations and fundraising. But what they do state is that they're fundraising to enable it to continue providing the standard of care and services that its clients need and value so greatly. Now, the clients are our children, and they do value it greatly, but where you have extensive waiting lists for those services, we'd be looking at therapeutic services like speech and language, physiotherapy, occupational therapy, specialist seating, and indeed they actually have a gait analysis laboratory up there, which is world class, but you know, where clients actually have to wait for those, parents are really disgusted at the moment to find out that there's been $3 million topped up to a pension fund, that you have, you know, management getting top-ups on top of their base salary that's been allocated by the HSC. But, you know, when we look at the HSC, they've known for 4 years about these top-up payments. Now, on one hand, you know, we have service providers who've been taken to the Labour Relations Court by staff over agreements that these disability sector services said that they couldn't fund any increases to staff payments or increments that may have been promised prior to the economic breakdown. So on one hand, you have staff who, they're not working for nothing, you know, they are salaried and they have their own employment rights. And on the other hand, you have services that are caught with reducing budgets that do have high staff costs. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's actually the children that are caught in the middle. I mean, the caveat to all of this is that we're only now taking out the magnifying glass and asking, where does the money really go, and how much of that do people donate in good faith actually goes directly to benefiting adults and children with disabilities who at the end of the day have little legal rights themselves to access those essential services. And we're at the mercy of decisions, budgetary decisions at government level, and then budgetary decisions which in each voluntary organisation operating in the disability sector. And we've had so little oversight in this whole area that, you know, we're just tipping the surface of this now. For parents, they just want to know that their children will get essential therapeutic services, and they're just not getting it at the moment.
You were talking there about the extent to which people with disabilities have to rely on charity fundraising. Are you worried that those fundraising efforts will be affected by this controversy?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I already know of parents who are connected with the CRC who would have been involved in fundraising through their annual Santa Bear appeal, which would be one of the main fundraising events for the CRC every year. And they're now pulling the plug on their support for this because they're looking at their own family's financial situation, as indeed, you know, we all are in these times. And they're now prioritising, is it a top-up to CEO salary, or is it looking after their own family? And that's unfortunate because there are costs that aren't covered through HSC agreements with these services. They do provide more than just therapeutic interventions. You know, there are additional services such as, you know, training for parents, talks for parents, you know, special groups for children, that particularly younger children during the week, you know, early intervention programs on a social level for children that wouldn't necessarily be covered through any HSE agreement plan. So there are additional benefits that are provided through fundraising, and in the CRC's own statement, you know, they do outline their whole capital buildings program. But again, you know, parents who are in those services, particularly in other areas outside of Dublin, you know, they're seeing these amazing buildings, but they're just not getting access to the therapeutic interventions in those buildings, and they're on long waiting lists, and they just don't see the point of having, you know, these wide open, well-designed buildings when there's just not the staff in there to provide the services.
Listen, thank you very much indeed for talking to us this morning. That was Lorraine Dempsey, Chair of the Special Needs Parents Association, and as I said, we'll have more on this later on in the programme. Joining us with the sports news is Dara Maloney. Good morning, Dara.
Rachel, good morning to you. Rory McIlroy is just two off the lead after the second round of the Australian Open in Sydney. He's 10 under par after a 65 and trailing Adam Scott, who of course is chasing the Aussie Triple Crown of their PGA, the Masters and the Australian Open. After his 62 yesterday, Scott had a 70 today. He is 12 under par. On the European Tour's Alfred Dunhill Championship in South Africa, Ricardo Santos leads on 7 under after 4. He's one clear of the field. Yet to start round 2, best of the Irish, Gareth Maben on 3 under par, and Kevin Phelan is on 2 under. Michael Hoey is 7 over after 6 holes. Now in soccer, Tottenham secured top spot in their Europa League group last night. They won 2-0 inside the Arctic Circle at Tromso. The win eased the pressure on the Spurs manager Andre Villas-Boas. Elsewhere, Swansea need a point from their final match to make the last 32 after last night's 1-0 home defeat to Valencia. The Spanish side have already qualified, and the Swansea manager Michael Laudrup believes they will still go for it in their final match.
With 1 point in the last game, we're 100% sure. We may not need that depending on what happens in Valencia. And again, you can say, yeah, but Valencia in the last game, they're not playing anything. No, but in the situation right now, they have to win every game because the people demand it.
Wigan conceded just 2 minutes from time at home to Zulte Waregem of Belgium to lose 2-1. They need to win their last match away to have a chance of going through. A win would have put them into the last 32 last night, and the Wigan manager Owen Coyle still believes they can do it.
It's still in your own hands. We have to go to Maribor and win, which we're more than capable of doing, and hope that Rubin Kazan won in Belgium. But it'd be nice to have, you know, decide your own fate. As it is, all we can do is continue to do our best, and that's what we'll do.
The Football Association of Ireland say there is no indication of any involvement in the match-fixing investigation by Britain's crime agency. The Daily Telegraph is reporting that an alleged match-fixer claimed he arranged World Cup qualification games and matches in this country, but it's not clear if he was referring to domestic or international matches. Two men have been charged as part of the investigation in Britain. They will appear in court later today. And the head of the Europe division of the International Players Union, Bobby Barnes, believes the English Premier League could be a major target for match fixers.
Unfortunately, we've already seen the impact that match fixing has had on several leagues throughout Eastern Europe and indeed in Asia, and without doubt the Premier League would be, given the size of the potential betting market, very much on the radar of these match fixers.
Shay Given has joined Middlesbrough on a one-month emergency loan. He could feature in tomorrow's match against Bolton. In rugby, England's clubs have come back from the brink of exclusion from European competition next season following a dramatic day in a dispute which is destined to continue for another year. Premiership Rugby has indicated it may be willing to participate in a tournament run by European Rugby Cup for next season if an acceptable alternative is in place for the following year. Yesterday, the French clubs agreed to commit to the ERC run format announced by the unions last week. Tonight in the Rabo Pro 12, the leaders Munster are away to the Dragons at 7:15. Connacht, who are in 12th and bottom of the table, are in need of points away to Edinburgh. And after a draw against the USA and defeats to New Zealand and Fiji, the Irish women's sevens team are playing France in the Dubai Sevens Bowl semi-final in Dubai later today. In boxing, the Olympic champion Katie Taylor returns to the ring in Dublin tonight as she continues her preparations for next year's European and World Championships. And finally for now, a line of snooker at the first round of the UK Championship in York. Ireland's David Morris beat Jamie Cope by 6-4 and now meets Peter Ebdon, but Ken Doherty was beaten 6-5 by John J. Astley.
Dara, thank you. It's looking increasingly likely this morning that the day after Ireland leaves the bailout next month, the country will be plunged into darkness. Trade unions representing workers at ESB will this afternoon formally issue notice of industrial action in a row over their pensions. We'll hear from one of those trade unions later. But first, let's talk to our industry and employment correspondent, Ingrid Miley. Ingrid Miley, good morning, Ingrid. Talks yesterday, but no progress, it seems. We're facing power cuts, yes?
Well, I wouldn't go as far as to say that just yet. I mean, clearly there is still a substantial risk of the strike going ahead. We're not sure if it's going to be an actual strike or a work to rule or what. So we are not sure what the nature and extent of the disruption might be. And most of all, we still have 2 weeks to talk about a solution to this. But yes, on foot of yesterday's meeting, which was described by unions as very, very robust, and by the ESB having as involving open and frank exchanges, and both agreeing there's that significant differences remain, they are going to be serving notice of industrial action formally today. And as things stand, we are still facing the prospect of difficulties with power.
At the heart of this row, the ESB's pension scheme and what sort of scheme it's regarded as by the company. Now, the ESB wouldn't talk to us this morning. Do they still maintain, as the unions claim, that it's not a defined benefit scheme?
This is highly complicated, Gavin. I mean, in some instances, they say it's a defined benefit scheme, but it's not a balance of cost defined benefit scheme. Does that make it the same as a defined contribution scheme? You'd need to have the wisdom of Solomon combined with an actuarial degree to figure that one out. But the key thing is that at the moment, the ESB and the group of unions are at odds about how this is treated on the company's balance sheet. Now, yesterday, and over the recent days, we've had a number of government ministers coming out to reassure the unions there is no deficit. If there is a deficit, it's going to be resolved by 2018. Everybody retiring before 2018 is going to get all their benefits, and no future deficit is forecast for after 2018 because the Pensions Board has accepted the funding proposal for the scheme. However, the unions are not buying that, and they are saying, well, if the government is so happy with this, is that effectively that they're underwriting the scheme? If they're underwriting the scheme, the company will have no problem putting this on the balance sheet. Now, I asked the Department of Communications, Energy and Natural Resources yesterday two very simple questions. One, is the government agreeing to underwrite this scheme? And B, is this a defined benefit or a defined contribution scheme? Now, clearly some guidance from the government on that one might help, but all I could get from the department was that Minister Rabbit was delighted that talks had got underway, and he feels that the parties should be given space to try and address their difficulties. So I think guidance on that would be helpful.
We'll be talking to Brendan Howland later. Do the government have any further stake in this row? Can they sort it out, for example?
Well, I don't see how it can be sorted out, through the usual channels, shall we say. The Labour Relations Commission and the Labour Court, I'm not sure that they will be anxious to step into this, because this is effectively, you know, is it actually an industrial dispute? It's about how a pension is accounted for on the books of this. Now, the Labour Court and the LRC have spent months, if not years, working on the Aer Lingus DAA pension scheme. They came up with a Labour Court ruling. It went to the Pensions Board and was rejected by the Pensions Board regulatory body. So maybe the Pensions Board is the place to go with this. But I think that the government does have a stake in this. A, it owns the company. B, it has, it is receiving dividends from this company. It's already received 78 million in a dividend this year. It's due to receive a further 400 million from the sale of assets in due course. And, you know, I think it is a strategic infrastructure for the country. So, yes, the stakes are very high for the government. I don't think that the population will be grateful if this is allowed to proceed to a dispute that causes outages in the run-up to Christmas. But what they can do with this without having implications for the balance sheet of the company, for borrowing by the company, remains to be seen.
Ingrid, thank you.
And quarterly results for Aircom show revenue and earnings still under pressure at the former semi-state. Revenue over the 3 months to the end of September was €323 million. That's down 9% compared to the same period last year. Earnings before accounting for interest on debt, which is a significant cost for Aircom, were down 1%. Richard Moat, Aircom's chief financial officer, said it's hoping the expansion of Aircom's fibre network to more homes and the addition of new services such as 4G mobile technology and internet television will help the company return to revenue and profit growth in the near future.
Our earnings have been moving within a very narrow band over the last five consecutive quarters. Revenue has continued to fall. It's down 9%, although that's at a lower rate of decline than we've seen in previous quarters. We want to continue the stability in earnings throughout the rest of this financial year, and then we hope to see growth and stability in revenue as we start to exploit the new products and services which we've recently introduced. High-speed fibre broadband, we're first operator to market with 4G, and most recently the launch of TV. So we think when we've got all of those out in the market that the top line will start to turn as well.
Richard Moat there, Aircom's chief financial officer. The renewable energy company Gaylectric has raised €90 million in new funding. The money comes from a variety of sources, including the National Pension Reserve Fund. Dublin-based Gaylectric will use the funds to invest in wind energy projects, among which is a wind farm in Derry, for which it has secured a €56 million debt facility from the German Landesbank NordLB. It'll also invest in some energy storage projects. Most of the remaining €34 million is made up of a €30 million investment by Blue Bay Ireland Corporate Credit, a substantial proportion of which comes from the NPRF. Consumer electronics retailer iConnect opens its first Irish outlet tomorrow as part of a planned €8 million investment in a number of new shops here between now and the end of 2014. The company, which specialises in Apple products, is backed by Qatar's Almana Group. Irishman John McAvoy, the general manager of Almana's technology division, will be with us at 10 to 8. Finally, for now, in currencies, the euro back over $1.36 this morning and steady at 83.3 pence sterling.
The intense moral pressure on hospitals and disability agencies to ditch the pay top-ups has had little effect so far. That's Eilish O'Regan writing in the Irish Independent this morning. The reality, she says, is that many of them are standing their ground and seem prepared to battle it out. There has been no great cave-in, even after the latest revelations that the Central Remedial Clinic top-ups were bankrolled by charity donations. And the top-up story makes the front pages of the Irish Times, the Independent, the Irish Daily Mail and the Irish Examiner. Five senior staff at the CRC are still in receipt of the top-up payment, says the Times. But the absence of a charities regulator may limit an inquiry, as legislation for a charity regulatory office has not yet been enacted, and officials expect it may not be in place until at least the second half of next year. The Independent says the CRC is now embroiled in a fresh controversy over pensions, and this is where the Mail comes in too. Philip Ryan reporting that an astonishing €3 million raised to help disabled children was instead used to top up pensions at the clinic. And the Examiner says the board of the CRC is facing calls to resign immediately. Also on the front of the Examiner, Noel Baker reports that children were sent to foster carers who were not assessed or approved, while five foster families were still caring for children despite having their applications to the service rejected. These are among the findings of an inspection report into fostering services in Cork, published by HICWA yesterday. Teens burn horse alive is the shocking headline on the Herald. Over a report from Ken Foy that a gang of teens, some as young as 13, doused a horse in petrol and burned it alive in a Dublin suburb. It pictures the corpse of the horse, which was just yards from the Lewis Red Line tracks in Talla. In other stories, Fionnán Sheehan in The Independent reports that Taoiseach Eamon Gilmore has tried to calm tensions in the coalition over assisted suicide by saying he is not pushing for legislation on euthanasia. Sheehan says that Taoiseach and the Taoiseach have been giving out different signals on the highly contentious issue on the back of a number of high-profile cases. In opinion this morning, UCD's John Coakley, writing in The Times, says we Irish may point the way to a deeper sense of EU identity. It may well be the case, he says, that the pillars on which Irish nationalism has relied in the past, such as its ancestral language, a perceived link to the Catholic tradition, and a militantly separatist version of history, have all been undermined over recent decades, leaving space for the growth of broader patterns of loyalty. And so to Italy. And UCC's Vittorio Buffacci is also writing in the Times about the legacy of Silvio Berlusconi. He believes Italy will remember Silvio only for his buffoonery. In terms of entertainment value, he will probably never be surpassed, he says. But sadly for Berlusconi, politics is a serious business. And right now, serious effort is required to get Italy out of the mess in which it finds itself after years of mismanagement and political opportunism. Finally, All the Papers preview RTE Television's toy show, which airs tonight. Hannah Louise Dunn in the Mail says host Ryan Tubridy is planning to showcase his limited tap dance moves in an opening tribute to Mary Poppins. But whether he will be stretching his vocal cords is still up for debate. He told the Mail, "I didn't realise how hard it is to dance." And he warned, "I might bottle it at this stage because it might just be too embarrassing for everyone."
And we'll be previewing the Late Late Toy Show a little later. Keane McCormack will be going behind the scenes ahead of tonight's programme. Valerie, thank you.
Turning next to an extremely upsetting and disturbing story. An abandoned horse has died after it was reportedly doused in petrol and set alight. The incident took place on Wednesday night close to the Lewis line between Talla and City West in Dublin. Gillian Bird is head of education with the Dublin Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Gillian, good morning.
Good morning.
How did you learn about what had happened?
We got the report yesterday morning, on Thursday morning, from the guards in Talla, and we went down and attended the scene.
What did you find when you got there?
Well, the inspector who went down there basically found the remains of the horse. It had been very, very badly burnt. He claims that he reckons there was an awful lot of liquid fuel used to actually ignite and keep this fire going hot enough to do this to the animal.
And at that stage, was the horse dead or was the horse still alive?
We got reports of the guards, or the guards got reports, that the animal was actually alive when it was set on fire. But unfortunately, we don't have witnesses who are prepared to come forward and give evidence.
It's hard for most people listening to imagine what sort of person would do something like this.
Absolutely. I mean, this is of great concern to the DSPCA and the guards, because this is somebody who's greatly lacking in empathy. And, you know, there is a link between people who can be deliberately cruel to animals to then the potential of going on and actually being harmful to humans.
I mean, just thinking about the Garda investigation, you would wonder, maybe you would hope that if there was a group of people there, that at least one of them would feel bad enough about this to maybe come forward and give some sort of information to the Garda or yourselves.
Absolutely. I mean, we find a lot of these situations, it is sort of the gang mentality that people end up going along with this because they're being egged on by people. But it is extremely upsetting.
What can be done to tackle this sort of behaviour?
Well, obviously the DSPCA are very active in the education. We educate to eradicate cruelty in the future and to try and promote responsible pet ownership. But obviously, I mean, the legislation is there to protect horses. The legislation is there to make sure that horses are not left unaccompanied in council areas. So we just need to see an enforcement of the legislation and a bit more responsible pet ownership.
And when you talk about enforcement of the legislation, who's not doing their job?
Well, it's a number of different things. I mean, obviously the public are very vocal about reporting horses, but I think sometimes they don't always know the correct place to report it to. Obviously, sick, injured and cruelly treated animals will come under our remit in the DSPCA. But really, it is the responsibility of the council to remove animals that are left on council land. And if you're a landowner and somebody has put animals on your land, it is your legal responsibility to see that those animals are being well cared for, or that the owners have permission from yourself to leave them there.
At the moment, are there many abandoned horses in Dublin?
It's very difficult to know how many are abandoned, how many are actually just left there by the owners. It's very difficult to know. The five live animals that were removed from site, none of them were microchipped. And obviously it was impossible for us to find the microchip on the dead horse. So it's really about knowing, are they abandoned or are they just left there by the owners to graze?
And just finally then, on this specific incident, I mean, there may be somebody who saw what was happening and maybe willing to come forward. Who do you think might be able to help you? I mean, can you give us the details of when and where this happened?
Well, we know this happened very late on Wednesday night. It happened there near one of the Lewis lines. People will know. If they were there, they will be well aware. It happened very close to a main road. And people who are there will know. And basically, the guards in Tala are just looking for information. Everything is confidential. They understand that they're you know, people are concerned about giving information. But do please, if you could help, because we really want to stop this sort of thing happening again.
Gillian, thank you very much for taking our call. Gillian Bird, who's Head of Education with the Dublin Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals.
King John's Castle in Limerick is being formally reopened this afternoon after a €5 million facelift to improve its visitor facilities. It's expected it will double its tourist numbers in the first year, and the aim is to bring that up to 200,000 visitors in the future. But should it even be called King John's Castle at all? Our Midwest correspondent, Cathy Halloran, has been finding out. She spoke first to John Ruddle, Chief Executive of Shannon Heritage.
The castle experience had got extremely tired over the years. There had been really nothing done, I suppose, since the 90s at King John's Castle. And we decided that it was so important to the city of Limerick, I suppose, in the wider region. We felt it was really a perfect opportunity to put an investment in and, I suppose, tell the story properly of the relevance of King John's to Limerick and the wider region.
Well, what's new? What can people expect that they may not have got in the famous story of King John's Castle in the past?
Well, we decided the general approach would be to use a whole lot of different methods of interpretation rather than just one. So what we've done is we've put in live animators who, I suppose, in just by being there, tell the whole story of the history of the castle. We've got storyboards, we've got interactive screens, we've got short films and audio visual presentations. We've got a lot of sort of background sounds, again, to create the atmosphere, wall projections, graphics, and of course for the children, lots of puzzles and games and discovery drawers for the children as well.
John Ruddle, Chief Executive of Shannon Heritage, explaining the background to the €5 million facelift to the castle completed over the past 2 years. It's one of the best preserved Norman castles in Europe, now equipped with state-of-the-art multimedia interactive technology and live actors to bring to life 800 years of history.
My role is as a Norman soldier, and I'm here to defend the walls and the King's Mint.
Built in 1210 on the orders of King John, its walls, towers and fortresses were strategically located along the River Shannon, as Liam Irwin, former Professor of History at Mary Immaculate College, explains.
It was, of course, designed to intimidate, to assert the new control which the Anglo-Normans had over Limerick, particularly sited on the Shannon to face directly the main threat, the O'Briens of Thomond over in County Clare. So it had that menacing element to it from the beginning. It didn't really have any direct military role until the 17th century, and then initially in 1642 when the Protestants of Limerick took refuge there, and they were besieged essentially by the Catholics of the city and eventually captured. And then its most dramatic and international significance, of course, came in 1691, when the armies of Europe, the French and the Danes and the Dutch, all were here, the French siding with Sarsfield and the Irish, and all of the other European nationalities with King William of Orange.
You don't believe King John's Castle is its correct name at all. Tell me about that.
First of all, there's no historical basis for it. Throughout all of the sources that one finds, it's all either always called Limerick Castle or the King's Castle or the Queen's Castle. It's not really until the 19th century, when it becomes a British Army barracks, that it begins to be called King John's Castle. And for all of those reasons, I think it should be much more appropriately called Limerick Castle.
That view aside, the investment in upgrading King John's Castle appears to be paying off. Visitor numbers have doubled, and there are plans for ambitious growth in the coming years.
The numbers before we revamped were about 42,000. This year we're going to hit about 85,000, but we're actually not stopping at that. We feel that we can get above 100,000, and over maybe a 2, 3, 4 year period we can get up to 150,000, 200,000 at King John's.
John Ruddle ending that report by Cathy Halloran, and the Castle opens its doors again this afternoon at 3 o'clock.
In the middle of the controversy surrounding top-up payments for hospital executives, it might be easy to forget patients and their families and the conditions they face. For example, a leading consultant in Temple Street Children's Hospital in Dublin has said overcrowding remains a huge problem there. Well, the government says it's confident of securing planning permission for the new children's hospital by the end of next year. That view isn't shared by all. Our reporter Aisling Kenny spent a morning at Temple Street.
You have to sleep on, there's just a chair by the bed, which is, it's very hard for a parent sleeping on a chair when they're staying, say, 5 nights. You're wrecked and you're tired. You find you can get a bit irritable, and you wouldn't have the same patience to deal with the child when you don't get your night's sleep.
Dolores Johnson has been attending Temple Street for the last 5 years, since her 11-year-old son Aidan was diagnosed with Guillain-Barré syndrome, a disorder that affects the nervous system. Dolores, along with many other parents, finds the overcrowded conditions in Temple Street very difficult.
It looks okay position-wise. Yeah.
Dr. Dermot Doherty is a consultant in the intensive care unit at Temple Street.
So where we struggle is that we need to free up a bed, but we can't get a patient who's well enough to leave to get out. And that's got to do with the clogging of the system of the hospital outside of the ICU. So that's a chronic problem, that they're getting beds, particularly beds that require isolation. That's children that have infections and need to be protect other patients. There's always a shortage of those.
Dr. Doherty says the lack of space in the hospital is a major issue.
This is a prefabricated temporary facility, so it's far from ideal. You know, you feel for the families coming in where the lack of privacy and the lack of or the inability to you know, to bring their the rest of their family or have privacy and discuss very critical time in a family's life is really far from ideal.
Valeria and Stephen's son Aaron is being treated at Temple Street. They say while the staff at the hospital are fantastic, the conditions they work in are extremely poor.
There's an elevator. There's one elevator for our area, but we've witnessed it on more than one occasion that it's not working. So we've got 4 flights of stairs that we have to come up instead. Now, luckily enough, we haven't had to have too much equipment up and down with us, but the bits and pieces that we've had to, yeah, you got to carry them.
And I have had to go up and down the stairs just after having him, when I was after having a cesarean, and that was difficult.
Yeah.
And
Bronya Bauer, Division Nurse Manager, Critical Care. Well, we haven't got enough space is the problem. We try and prioritise what's key, so the patients would come first, and we'd, you know, make sure that we'd have enough area space around the beds, but even that's tricky in some areas. And then after that, then, I mean, you can see we're sitting in an office here at the moment that a parent could be brought into to, you know, give bad news. It's, you know, it's very limited space. We have parents' accommodation. Parents are now always looking to stay with their families, and we have a very limited number of rooms. We try and prioritise them for, you know, for parents, say, with mothers who are breastfeeding, mothers coming up from the country, fathers coming up from the country. We'd love to give more out, but we can't. So we just have to prioritise, you know, what's available and what's not.
Jennifer Keely is from Clonmel in County Tipperary. Her baby daughter Ella is being treated in Temple Street for a bowel problem.
It's so expensive. Like, I travel by train 3 times a week, and it's €45 return each time. So that's 3 times a week I have to pay €45 to come up and down. Oh, it's so tough. It's an emotional roller coaster, because when I leave here, I'm crying because I'm leaving Ella. And when I'm at home, then you're upset because you're missing her and you're so far away.
Yeah, no, she had been in the first term, she had been relatively sick.
Back in the intensive care unit, Dr. Dermot Doherty says he's worried about the slow progress of the new National Children's Hospital.
We can't go on like this, because this, as you can see, this place is crumbling. You know, there's a huge amount of work goes into this building every day, and but, you know, there are systems failing every day as well. I'm profoundly disappointed that that we are not further along. I came back from abroad a couple of years ago with the idea of joining a brand new hospital, and I'm not holding my breath.
And that was Dr. Dermot Doherty ending that report from Aisling Kenny.
Rachel, Aircom says it's expanding the footprint of its fibre network to cover 1.4 million homes rather than the 1.2 million originally planned by 2016. The telecoms firm this morning reported a 9% fall in revenue and a 1% drop in earnings before interest, tax, depreciation and amortisation over the 3 months to the end of September. Speaking earlier on Morning Ireland, Aircom's Chief Financial Officer Richard Moat said it hoped the investment in fibre and the rollout of new services such as internet television would help the company return to revenue and profit growth in the near future. Consumer electronics retailer iConnect will tomorrow open the first of a number of outlets it's planning to open across the country. iConnect, which specialises in reselling Apple products, is backed by Qatar's Almana Group. John McAvoy is the general manager of Almana's technology division and is with us now in studio. John, it's still quite a tough retail market here, I suppose, as evidenced by the appointment of a receiver to the fashion retailer Awear over the past 24 hours. That's the maelstrom into which you're plunging now.
Yes, good morning, Connor. Thank you for having me on. There's a changing market at the moment. You know, we're very excited to bring this investment back home to Ireland. You know, foremost being Irish, it's great for me to be able to bring, you know, the jobs back home, the investment. It's a great technology environment here. There's some sadness in the high street, I think, at the moment. It's great to be able to get that inspiration back in, you know, get customers encouraged to come out to the stores. We're very excited to do that. I think it's going to be a challenge for us. However, hopefully the investment, the people we have on board, you know, the technology, everyone loves Apple. It's a great time to start in the market. From a business fact perspective, you know, we have opportunity to scale very fast, which is going to get the brand out, going to get customers into store, and we're very excited.
And what is the rollout plan then? Initially, you're opening, I think, Liffey Valley is the first one, is it, in West Dublin?
Yes, Liffey Valley is tomorrow, so we're all hands on deck for Liffey Valley tomorrow. We've got quite a rapid growth plan for next year. So two stores before Christmas, one in Liffey Valley, and we're going to head towards Kildare, Newbridge, in 2 weeks. And next year, we're going to scale across the smaller towns and communities in Ireland, which is part of our vision, really, to get into the heart of the communities.
I mentioned it's a difficult market, but of course, at the same time, timing is not the worst thing in that you're opening, obviously, in the run-up to Christmas. Are you expecting the Apple juggernaut to keep rolling then, that there'll be big demand for iPads, for iPhones et al. In the run-up to Christmas?
Yes, of course. I mean, the excitement at the moment, you know, from a social media point of view about our launch, you know, people asking for certain products, will you have this in stock? It's quite an exciting time for us. You know, the Apple product is at a premium price point. So we appreciate that customers, you know, are going to really stretch themselves sometimes before Christmas to get these products for their families. So we're very much ready to cope with that demand. We've got our products ready in store, great stock, and excited to welcome the customers tomorrow.
Does it help or hurt in the sense that there's a lot of buzz, for example, around the new PlayStation 4, Xbox One? There's a lot of consumer electronic stories, I guess, happening at the moment. But at the same time, there's a lot of competition for people's hard-earned income.
Of course. I think that attracts consumers, you know, to the knowledge of that there's a new product coming out. There's a gaming environment. Apple at the moment is very much in that environment of learning and education piece. You know, customers like to move away from a certain platform. They need to learn about their Apple product. Their families use them. Kids are using iPads in schools. You know, we separate the Xbox and the PlayStation. It gets excitement going for new electronics. However, we separate that from the Apple experience.
The environment for that sort of retailing has changed a lot, hasn't it? There was a time when a lot of people just ordered computers, for example, from Dell online. Now people really want to go into store and play with them.
Yes, of course. I was one of those people that, you know, and still the online model is working very well, but the test driving is which is an Apple premium reseller does best is what it's all about. Customers are needing to remove that fear factor, especially around Apple, where they're maybe transferring from a Windows machine. They're a bit nervous, and that's what we're there to do in store for our experts.
You'll be
there
hoping to help a lot of them while you roll out the iConnect stores. John McAvoy, thanks very much for coming into us this morning. The euro trading at $1.36 this morning, and at the moment at just over 83 pence sterling.
Good morning. Outbreaks of rain in the north will continue to move southwards over the country this morning, becoming very light and patchy. Brighter weather with sunny spells and scattered showers will follow from the northwest, reaching all parts by early afternoon, and the showers will be mainly in Connacht and Ulster. It is going to feel cooler than recently, highest temperatures 8 to 10 degrees. In fresh northwesterly winds, these winds very blustery around coasts in the north and northeast. There will still be a few showers near northern and western coasts tonight, but most places will be dry with clear spells. It's going to be cold with the winds moderating and a touch of frost forming locally in sheltered rural areas. Lowest temperatures 1 to 5 degrees. Tomorrow will be cool, mainly dry and quite breezy with a mix of cloud and some brighter sunny intervals. Highest temperatures 9 or 10 degrees in moderate northwesterly winds. Tomorrow night will be dry with the winds decreasing light. It's going to turn cold with some frost likely to form and some mist and fog patches developing as well. Then Sunday will be a dry day, some brighter sunny spells developing in places. And after the cold start, temperatures will rise to between 7 and 10 degrees. It'll be mildest in the north and there will be very little wind or calm conditions. Frost and fog will then return under cloud breaks on Sunday night. And for Monday, a light southerly breeze will develop. It will continue dry with a mix of cloud and some brighter spells. Tuesday then will bring some rain to northern parts of the country, but it should hold dry further south. This rain will edge southwards on Tuesday night and early Wednesday, petering out. It will brighten up on Wednesday with sunny spells, but it is going to be colder and frosty conditions following on Wednesday night. But for today, outbreaks of rain moving south this morning, petering out, followed by sunshine and a few showers, turning blustery and feeling cooler with highest temperatures of 8 to 10 degrees. Good morning.